Welcome back to another episode of Election Watch, brought to you by Politics Unboxed and Expression FM News. It's a pleasure to welcome you back. My name is Rhys, and joining me to discuss a very, very important topic that is making headlines across the pond, but not here yet, are our wonderful regular contributors, Vicky and Callum. So, I don't know whether we have any further ado in this bit, because there's a lot we need to talk about in the course of this episode. So let's dive straight into it with Election Watch. Election Watch. So today we'll be talking about the 2022 US midterm elections, the biggest set of elections outside of a presidential cycle in the United States. They're going to be held on Tuesday, November the 8th this year. All 435 seats in the House of Representatives are up for grabs, as well as 39 Senate seats. Don't forget, of course, 39 state and territorial gubernatorial elections and plenty of other down ballot races are going to be contested. So this is a massive, massive set of elections. It's going to decide the shape of the 118th Congress. And crucially, this is affected by the 2020 census redistricting. So for those of you who aren't aware of how the election maps are really drawn in the US, a term you might have heard is gerrymandering. It gets thrown around quite a lot. But essentially, the state electoral maps, they are often drawn up at the whim of those elected at the highest level in that state. So the governor's office, the secretary of state's office, they mainly have the power to certify election results. And now, after that 2020 census, obviously every 10 years, they have had a chance to redraw some of those lines. And now those lines are where the battles are going to be fought. So I think let's start with a nice little broad brush look at what is up for grabs. Because at the moment, the Democrats have at least nominal control over all three branches of the sort of decision-making bodies that are elected in the United States. The presidency, obviously held by Joe Biden. You have the House of Representatives, which currently has a Democratic majority, although we'll be talking about that very, very soon. And the Senate, which is a 50-50 split, but in the event of ties, Kamala Harris, the vice president, gets to cast the deciding vote. So with that said, the Democrats, they have everything to lose in terms of political control in this election. Realistically, the only thing that can't be wrestled from their hands is the presidency. So I wonder, I'll hand over to my panelists, what you guys are thinking about the overall chances for the Democrats and for the Republicans who are looking to regain control of the House and the Senate. So what do you think their chances are in this set of midterm elections?
I would argue that Republicans seem to be trying to take win defeat from the jaws of victory, whatever it is. I think they're pretty set on to kind of cruise through to win both the House and the Senate with a kind of message about inflation, COVID not being over, Democrats not doing what they promised type rhetoric that would win over some independents and get their base out there. However, kind of the nomination of some more radical candidates, as well as decisions by the Supreme Court, have kind of shifted the narrative to more woke culture war kind of discussions, which can turn off some independents, as well as abortion discussions, which really motivate some people who haven't voted to come out and vote or to switch over. And they're no longer playing on the playing field that suits them, which is the economy, where they have an advantage. And that, in addition to the fact that the Democrats are now seeming to do a bit better, they've passed some major legislation through recently, which seems to be polling very well. It's kind of attacking issues that most voters care about, which means the Democrats now can also point to helping solve inflation while also talking about extremism in terms of democracy, culture wars, abortion, which they're hoping will motivate new voters.
Yeah, it's very much kind of the Democrats' election to lose. I mean, I would be hesitant to say one way or the other for definite and or like with a good amount of confidence, simply because nature of these things is it's not decided until the day. There could very much be some kind of massive change up in, and we've seen it consistently through presidential elections and midterm elections, that until that day, it is still up in the air. All the polls could very much be like entirely wrong in terms of what might happen. But I do agree that it is basically the Democrats' election to lose, and that Republicans do seem to be trying to snatch defeat from the jaws of victory. It's an interesting set of issues that the both parties have seemed to focus on alongside the inflation reduction. Obviously, Democrats have recently, the big kind of legislative point at this moment has been student debt forgiveness as well, and that's been, and I know that they've kind of almost taken on a more kind of aggressive tack when Republicans have been saying, oh, this was a bad decision or so on and so forth, because they've been pointing out the loan forgivenesses that their election campaigns or private organizations which they are involved with have had. And not only with those who are seeking office, but also some conservative commentators, like I believe that Ben Shapiro was one who got kind of viewed by the White House Twitter, amongst other things. But it's a bit of a mixed bag, because alongside you've got a really incensed Republican base at the moment between ongoing ire about the result of the election, and especially recently with the raid on Mar-a-Lago and everything concerning that, and what certain voices are saying about those sorts of investigations. So it is very much going to be decided on the day, and I think we are very much at the point now where it could be anyone's. It's the Democrats' election to lose, but they've lost in that context before.
Yeah, I think this is definitely a different Democratic Party than what we saw in 2020. And I know it seems quite weird to say that when there's only 2 years in between the elections. Obviously, everything is crammed into these repeating two-year cycles in America, with the entirety of the House of Representatives up for election every 2 years. I mean, you wonder why there's so much legislative gridlock. It's because half the people probably aren't going to be there in 4 years' time. But this is a very much more combative Democratic Party. In 2020, I think they felt the need to be an anchor in a storm. There was a lot of feeling on the Democratic side that all they had to do was essentially run a Warren G. Harding campaign 100 years on, a return to normalcy. We even heard that word, a word that has only really popped up in two election campaigns. It just so happens they're 100 years apart for different political parties. It's an odd statistical quirk, which I quite like pointing out. But this time around, it's as if the Democrats have seen what's been going on. They've seen the Republican Party shift even further away from the party of George W. Bush Republicanism. And by the way, that's not saying that George W. Bush was a centrist. He was an avowed neoconservative. Alongside Dick Cheney, he headed up one of the most right-wing administrations in American history, if you look back at all of American history, especially in terms of foreign policy and tax cuts. But that party, that Republican Party, just doesn't exist anymore. And neither does the Supreme Court that the Democrats had tried to rely on in many cases where they felt there was legislative overreach. Well, that Supreme Court is now siding with the Jackson Board of Health. In notable decisions, it's no longer enough for the Democrats to say, well, look, we'll be nice, we'll be bipartisan, we'll reach across the aisle, because the aisle is shifting further and further because the Democrats are letting it shift further and further. So this is a Democratic Party with, make no mistake, its back considerably up against the wall. It either has to fight or it's probably over, because if the Republicans can somehow get into a position where the Trump wing of the party is strong enough to fight an election, and there is a considerable number of sort of Romney, Cheney, Bush-style Republicans, then that's two political parties of force against the Democrats, who are already fractured into factions anyway. Look at Bernie Sanders criticizing Joe Biden just over 9 months ago. I can't remember what it was about, but there have been numerous Democrats, Joe Manchin, Kristen Sinema, who repeatedly take a hail of bullets, metaphorically, from the squad, who then get the same level of treatment back from people within their own party. The Democrats are now really having to fight for what they believe in. There's been so much recently of "I'm not Donald Trump" from Joe Biden. Now I think we're finally seeing why he's Joe Biden, and the Democrats are following his lead. They're saying what they're fighting for, not just what they're fighting against. It's a refreshing change. Is it too little too late? I have no idea. I wonder what you guys think on that particular bit.
In some terms, they've allowed a message to gather and a kind of theory about them to gather for several years in the media, and that's going to be quite hard to change. But then you could also argue that the narrative that certain right-wing publications like Fox News or even some like commentators on CNN, the language they would use about the Democratic Party, they've already decided. And it didn't really matter what they did. They were going to call them too focused on woke ideas and culture and like pronouns and stuff to do anything, and they don't care about you. They only care about the Ivy League schools or coastal elites and stuff like that. So this sounds really bad, but I'm not sure in terms of like media and stuff, I'm not sure it actually matters what they've done, because the people watching that have kind of already made up their minds. Where it helps is where it would make a difference is what they've done over student loans, infrastructure, stuff they've done on prescription drug prices, things like that. If that can make an effect for people before they vote in the midterms, if people can actually see the impact of that in their real lives, that could help. But for things like infrastructure, that's unlikely, because that's such a long-term project. Other things, perhaps they might see the prescription drug stuff, but who knows? I think it's going to be more impactful in the next 2024 election than it would be in the midterms.
Yeah, I certainly think there was a strategic call, because honestly, I don't think they needed to be massively combative with the 2020 election. It was not a case of this was clearly something which we need to fight for. We just need to show that it was more that Democrats needed to show that they would be willing to fight if necessary, but they weren't going to fight the American people. They were showing that the American people, regardless of whether they voted for them or not, were not the enemy. I mean, it's still quite something when the Tea Party is not regarded as the extreme of the Republican Party. It was Sorkin got a few years ago, back in Obama's run. He wrote for the newsroom that literally referred to them, he referred to them as the American Taliban in the newsroom, essentially. And now we've got this MAGA caucus, which makes them look, for all accounts, whilst they are definitely not centrists in terms of how politics stands, they seem centrist, which is quite significant. Like, if you're able to make Mitch McConnell seem somewhat reasonable, that's concerning. But I think now the Democrats have realized, now they've got that power, now they've got as thin a margin as it is, now they have got both houses, they know they can fight for this without necessarily, you know, getting absolutely decimated. They know they've managed to kind of get some peace for the country, but now is the time to fight, essentially. It is time to kind of show not just that they're willing to kind of, they're not going to fight against the people, they're going to fight for them. That is what is the important message in these midterms.
Yeah, I mean, it's crucial to see the messaging that's coming across from the parties, because people have quite rightly been angry about a number of different things across the whole range of the political spectrum. If you look at how the Democrats are fighting this campaign, yes, they want to talk about economic aid, but they really want to get into the nuts and bolts of social issues, because that is where their base is energized to vote. They want to vote on issues like abortion. They want to vote on social policies. They really want to get into how the country should be run, not how the country is fiscally run. And I'm not saying that's not an important factor. Of course, the economy, what was it, Bill Clinton's campaign manager said, it's the economy, stupid. That's how you win an election. But this time around, the Democrats can't fight on the economy, realistically, because if they fight on the economy, all that the Republicans have to do is find a way to link them to the inflation crisis, which is very, very easy when you're the party in power. Now, this is not me saying that the Democrats have caused the inflation crisis, because that would be factually inaccurate. But it's also not me saying that there isn't part of the reason why the inflation crisis is happening to that extent in America that can be placed on the Democrats. Of course, there are things that happen that do cause contributory factors. But speaking of where these fights are going to be happening in certain House seats and Senate seats, it really is important to look at the actual playing field, because I know I told all of you guys that there are 435 seats up for grabs and there are 35 Senate seats. Well, realistically, if we see an actual battle in all of those seats, it would be one of the biggest shocks in American political history to have an actual battle in some of those seats. So I'm on the Politico 2022 midterm election forecast, looking at a great piece of analysis by Steve Shepard, who is the chief election reporter, and he does a lot of the forecasting reviews, the sort of big picture stuff. Think of him almost as the American John Curtis, but significantly younger and with less wacky hair. He has put out a rating system for all 435 House seats and all 35 Senate seats that are up for grabs this time around. And, well, essentially, 310 of them are solidly one party or another. Basically, they're not going anywhere soon. It's 151 solid Democratic seats and 159 solid Republican seats. Moving on, 23 of them he's rated as likely Democratic, 35 likely Republican, 21 lean Democratic, 18 lean Republican, and there are 28 where the battleground is so tight that it's essentially a toss-up. So the Republicans aren't going to be spending too much time and too much money in those 151 solid Democrat seats. The Democrats aren't going to spend time and money in that 159 Republican seats that are solidly Republican. The real battle is going to be fought over the 53 leaning to likely Republican seats, the 44 leaning to likely Democrat seats, and the 28 absolute toss-up seats. So where are they? Where are these seats that we should be looking out for as bellwethers It always used to be, where did Ohio go in presidential elections? But now they seem to have lost that status. So what should we be looking out for? And there's a great set of things around here. If you're looking to see if the Republicans are losing a bit of ground, you might want to check out California's 27th electoral district. Representative Mike Garcia, he might be the most vulnerable Republican in the country, because the area he's in, well, it voted for Joe Biden by 13 percentage points. Michigan's 7th district, if you want to see how Representative Alyssa Slotkin is going, well, this could be a good indicator of how the Democrats are doing. Are they holding ground? The Republicans think they can oust her from her seat. There's plenty more to have a look at, but I wonder, what do you guys think in terms of where this battle's going to be fought? Because we know roughly along the policy lines, but in terms of where to look in the House, what do we think? Where do you think you should be sort of looking to see how the wind is going?
I mean, we're going to be, it's going to be looking at those, right? I mean, you would know far more of the individual dynamics of this district, having it up on political at the moment. But yeah, it's certainly, I mean, there's going to certainly be states which, where the presidential election was a lot closer, or there was a upset of a result in particular districts, that is going to be where there is potential for a massive change up. Whether that's kind of, whether it actually translates is going to be dependent on so many factors, including general sentiments of the Republican Party and the Democrats, and of whether people feel they made the right vote, to whether those districts are the same shape and the same size. Now, I mean, you mentioned in your introduction about gerrymandering and the redrawing of district lines, which can go down to like the street level, to like excluding a particular house. And there's like plenty of documentation of when that's been used for less than numerical means, let's say. But yeah, it's going to be, there are going to, I think those, definitely those closer call prediction races, it is going to be looking to. But yeah, look at the 2020 election compared to perhaps 2016 at the presidential level, and definitely look at those where there's been kind of an upset in between those two, where there's been a significant difference. Not necessarily, there's definitely those which just flip-flop consistently, but ones which were more stably one or the other, but have now switched or are now a bit more purple, that's going to be the interesting place to look.
I mean, I suppose something else to look out for is seats in places like Nebraska, Texas, places like that, where they were held by Trump by like single figure percentage points. But you could maybe think about, or if he doesn't motivate the same turnout, if Democrats can beat Republicans on turnout, that seat can look very, very different. And whether these figures who were kind of elected in a wave that came about through Donald Trump can hold on an election where Donald Trump might not be as prominent, or Republicans might try and make him less prominent. So that's an interesting scenario to see if kind of those voter trends are set, or were a very kind of one time only Trumpism phenomenon.
I just want to bring to everyone's attention a report by The Guardian in February of this year, which has said that America is poised to have staggeringly low numbers of competitive seats in the US House. And they quote figures from the 2020 redistricting cycle. It says that roughly 94% of the House of Representatives will be decided by a safe seat, or a relatively safe seat. So this shines a magnifying glass onto this idea that we're talking about in terms of there really aren't that many places this election can be won or lost in. But eight of those places had multiple incumbents running for the same seat, which is an odd phrase to say. It's not a phrase I've had to say in UK elections for some time. You might yet hear me have to say it if the redistricting goes through in 2023, as in the Boundary Commission review, so keep an ear out for any of that. But this is quite simply weird. As we know, as I've been saying, there've been redistricting efforts in America since 2020. It has shoved a couple of big districts together, and some of them had two incumbents who wanted to keep on running again. Some of them were from the same party, so have been dumped out in the primaries. Others, in fact, I think there are only two now where there are incumbents facing off against each other in the direct general election, and that is the second congressional district in Florida, where Neil Dunn and Al Lawson are going head to head, and the 34th district in Texas, where Myra Flores and Vicente Gonzalez are going head to head, which makes them actually physically purple state, purple districts, because they both have an incumbent Democrat and an incumbent Republican running for their seat, which is mental. In any other country or in any other system where the redistricting isn't done like this, that would be a once in a generation sort of sight to see a couple of incumbents. We're seeing two in the same election, and there were six same party double incumbencies. All of those have been hammered out. There were two in Illinois. Two double incumbencies. Ridiculous. New York's 12th was the biggest one, though, because that had Jerry Nadler and Carolyn Maloney. Now, both of them very prominent Democrats. Maloney, she was chair of the House Oversight Committee. Doesn't look like she's going to be there next time. She lost the primary to Jerry Nadler. It's just funny seeing these two stalwart Democrats having to campaign against each other properly in a primary anymore. Maloney called Jerry Nadler senile. Jerry Nadler shot back. He's, of course, chair of the House Judiciary Committee, a very, very prominent Democrat. He's been in the House of Representatives since 1992 and been in Democratic state politics since 1977. What's he said this time? It's very interesting to sort of see what it was. It was quite a bitter campaign. He did end up winning quite comfortably, to be honest. But he's really stolen Carolyn Maloney's seat because the majority of that district was hers. It's just interesting to find these little races that give a small insight, just a small one, into how this race is going to be run. But let's jump back to some of the maybe less politically quirky and more politically relevant races. Big races going on up and down the USA. It's going to be a tight election. We don't really know which way this is going to go in the House. If you look at Politico's rating, well, they say that it is likely that it will go Republican, and that is the second strongest rating that Politico can give it in one way or another. It's not even a lean. Now that is close. Most people have been predicting that the Republicans would lose much more ground in 2020, and they really didn't. Nancy Pelosi was disappointed with just 221 House seats. Remember, that's only three over the majority line. So really, they're clinging on by their fingernails here, the Democrats. Just want to bring to your attention two more races. One of them, Nebraska's second district. Nebraska's second is a wonderful little quirk of electoral analysis, because Nebraska, unlike 48 of the other states that send electoral college members to vote for the presidency, Nebraska, Maine's the only other one, by the way, splits how they award their electoral college votes into two, go to the winner of the overall state vote, and then it goes district by district throughout their three congressional districts. And the second congressional district is sort of the most Democrat of them all. If you see a bit of blue in Nebraska, it's almost always CD2. Now, Donald Trump has been actively courting challengers for this seat to try and find someone to run in it, but they all have basically fallen by the wayside, because the incumbent, Republican Representative Dawn Bacon, looks like he is still there. That's bad for Trumpism, but it's great for the Republicans, because he's practically the only Nebraskan Republican who can hold this seat. There's really no one else. The other one to look at is Virginia's 7th. Abigail Spanberger, she's going for a third term. Biden won the district by 6 points in 2020. Virginia, of course, though, had its gubernatorial election in 2021, and Glenn Youngkin, the Republican, won it. So those are two ones to keep a look on, both rated as leaning towards the incumbent. But if you see people losing ground, gaining ground there, those are two big districts to have a look at. So I wonder, are we feeling bold, guys? What do we think about some predictions for how these races might go? Or what do you think is going to happen at the very top of these parties? People like Nancy Pelosi, Kevin McCarthy. How do we feel this is going to go by November the 8th?
I think the Republicans will probably take the House. They may not take it by a lot, but I just think it may be too much ground for the Democrats to catch up on, especially with House elections, because they happen so frequently and the terms are so short. It's kind of less about candidate, more about kind of general national trends. And with inflation still on people's minds, and it's kind of less extreme candidates for the House elections than you get in the Senate, I think Republicans may be able to kind of eke out a victory on just, you generally trust us over the Democrats on the economy. People tend to vote against the president in midterms elections and win there. I mean, who knows? If the Democrats can get loads of people out to vote, maybe it can help flip the House. Well, not flip the House, keep the House, but I'm not confident.
Yeah, no, I'm kind of the same mind. I think keeping the Democrats will likely keep the Senate, at least. I think there's too much of kind of feelings about kind of the toxicity almost of the Republican Senate party. I said that all in the wrong order, but you get what I mean. But yeah, especially considering how relatively there's been kind of not as much scandal with the majority of the House elections, I think it is very possible that the Republicans could take the House, not by any significant margin, but certainly a better margin than the Democrats currently have. So yeah, it is very much going to be, it's unfortunately Kamala Harris's voice won't carry as much weight by any means.
Well, I think if sticking with the House briefly before turning our attention fully onto the Senate, where really everything is to blame for, there are some big pointers saying where things look like they're going. I would say I agree with you guys. It looks like it's going Republican. I would imagine they will have a stronger grip on the House of Representatives than the Democrats do now. Obviously, that is before we've even heard what the October surprise is going to be. So you never really know until the fat lady sings in US elections. There's always something. It was Trump getting COVID back in September of 2020. That was a big autumn surprise. Think back to 2016. You had the emails, Hillary Clinton's investigation, or the FBI's investigation into Hillary Clinton. The FBI playing a crucial role in this election as well, it would seem, getting out the vote for both the Democrats and the Trump base, riling them up to equal measures. One side saying they should be investigating and prosecuting immediately, the others saying it's a horrendous miscarriage and abuse of the judicial system by a partisan political power. So this really is a bit too early, probably, for sane people to make electoral predictions. But who said anything about anyone being sane here on Election Watch? We do political watching for a podcast. Come on, guys, you could have seen through the clues a little bit earlier. There are a couple of big seats that I didn't get time to talk about in terms of pointers. One of them, Wyoming's at-large congressional district. Liz Cheney, gone. Gone. One of the key so-called moderate Republicans, one of the few Republicans who openly spoke out against President Trump and really didn't hold back. She was full-throated in her condemnation of the president and what she saw as his instigation of the riot on January the 6th. At the other end of the scale, you have Madison Cawthorn, who was the darling of the MAGA right, the congressman from North Carolina. Well, come November, the congressman from North Carolina no longer, you would imagine, given that he's lost his primary challenge. He hit the headlines in all the wrong ways in recent news. I won't go into too much detail here for fear of the libel lawsuit, but there's a lot to unpack about Madison Cawthorn's stimulus package. No, that's a bit too on the nose. So there's plenty to have a look at on the Republican side. On the Democrat side, I talked a little bit about Jerry Nadler and his battle to remain a New York congressman. Nancy Pelosi fighting for the future of the Democratic Party, it would seem. Which way is it going to go? How much longer can she stay the figurehead of the Democratic Party? I mean, she's 83. It's madness. Fighting an election every 2 years at age 83. I don't want to be doing that. If I'm in politics, I want to have a nice retirement, a Grace and Favour mansion by then, and a nice cup of cocoa by the fire with a book. All credit to her for carrying on and fighting for what she believes in. There's an appetite for change in the Democratic Party, and I wonder if this election goes bad, whether this is the end of Nancy Pelosi as one of the big roles in a Democratic House party. Right then, let's turn to where the real prizes are up for grabs, because yes, the House of Representatives is incredibly important, but it gets elected every 2 years. If you don't win in 2022, you have a chance to take control again in 2024 and 2026 and 2028. You get the picture. In the Senate, if you thought there were safe seats in the House of Representatives, boy oh boy, you have not met the United States Senate. Mitch McConnell's been in there since, what, 1985? It's ridiculous lengths of tenure. If someone is a popular incumbent, they will be the senator from that state until the end of their natural lives, some of them. And that's a much more common thing than you would imagine for some positions that are so powerful. But let's have a look at the Senate, because there are 35 Senate seats up for grabs, and there are some absolute crackers. If you look at the races, there are some brilliant contests to have a look at. My personal favorite, just from watching it, is the Pennsylvania Senate race, where you have two of the least conventional candidates, I think probably in the history of Senate races, where it's realistically between the final two candidates. Still listed as a toss-up, this race between John Fetterman and TV Dr. Mehmet Oz for the Republican Party. Very much a Trump endorsement versus almost like a Bernie Sanders style of Democrat, real grassroots, get out the vote, croaky voice, controversial, sort of quirky figure. Big race to look at. Georgia, you have the upstanding, upright Reverend Raphael Warnock for the Democrats, who spectacularly won in 2020, versus the former NFL footballer Herschel Walker, who is just about doing everything a successful political candidate shouldn't do, but is still in the race, still realistically in with a chance. Arizona, an astronaut is running again, Mark Kelly, astronaut and senator. Popular in the state, is he popular enough to keep it blue amongst this potential for a red wave? You never know. And then there's races up and down the country. So I'm going to throw it over to you guys for a little bit. I want to hear where you're looking, where the interesting races are, and where the real battles are going to be fought.
I mean, I think you've done a good job highlighting the key ones. Pennsylvania, as pointed out, is just interesting because of how well the Fetterman campaign has run it. I mean, the candidate had a stroke a couple of months ago and hasn't been able to campaign properly, and his team have just like taken the ball and run with it and have produced some of the funniest political campaigns you've ever seen. Like the sarcasm they're using against Dr. Oz, the videos they're using, it's just brilliant. It's like a real like masterclass in how to run a digital campaign and attract attention, and has really denied Republicans the chance of Pennsylvania, I think, which they would have been really looking on as almost a dead cert as a flip for them. And I mean, Dr. Oz isn't a great candidate, but Fetterman has just really gone for it. Arizona, I have real hopes for Mark Kelly to kind of cling on. Firstly, just as I pointed out, he's an astronaut, and that's just cool. And I think that's like he's such a cool, like he's a really cool candidate. Like as candidates matter in elections, like the whole astronaut thing he's got going for him, it just makes him stand out. But more sensibly, because it would really show kind of how badly Kirsten Sinema has handled things, because her argument for like standing in the way of every Democratic piece of legislation for the last 2 years is that her kind of Senate seat, her people, Amazonians don't support it. So if Mark Kelly can cling on to his seat, it would show that Kirsten Sinema is wrong in that regard. Amazonians do support what the Democrats are doing, and kind of take that away from her, which I'd kind of find personally quite rewarding. And then Georgia as well, Raphael Warnock is running a good, slightly less attention grabbing, but a good campaign. Herschel Walker has kind of got all the attention in that race, but that's because of what he's said, which is interesting. And I really hope he can like pull through and show that like candidate does matter. And if you put a really insane extreme candidate out, that can halt your chances. And that maybe, hopefully, that could dissuade parties from going to that extreme again, because it would show that like they've thrown away really open chances, the Republicans, if Herschel Walker loses. So who knows? Mitch McConnell's obviously concerned, because he did an interview where he said he didn't think, basically thought the Senate was unlikely to win, which is unusual for Mitch McConnell to say. And he blamed candidate quality, which was a bit of a shot at Donald Trump, which is, again, unusual for Mitch McConnell. So I'll be interested to see if they do lose the Senate, or not lose the Senate, if they don't win the Senate, what that does for how the party works, how its relationship to Donald Trump. Because if they don't win the Senate, I think this blame can squarely go on the extreme candidates that were nominated in swing seats. And the reason extreme candidates were nominated in swing seats is because they were backed by Donald Trump. And that's a bit of a kind of shot in the foot. And who knows where that would lead.
Yeah, I mean, in both the cases of Pennsylvania race and the Georgia race, we are seeing essentially like the kind of result of Trump's victory in sense, not only in that they endorse, but these are candidates without really all that much political background. They're more so public personas essentially than anything political, and but have kind of tossed their hat in the ring. It's definitely going to be one to watch between Oz and Fetterman. There's been quite a few jibes back and forth. I mean, different scales. Fetterman making a good point that up until recently, Oz did not at all officially reside in Pennsylvania and solely moved for the purposes of the election, or at least for all appearances, that seemed to be the case. Unfortunately, the jibes which the Oz campaign has been sending back have been less tolerant, and they have been almost poking fun at the fact that Fetterman is a stroke survivor. So possibly a demonstration of what not to do in the campaign, as I'm pretty sure, regardless of party politics, you do not, it is a low blow to go after your opponent's health, certainly if you're someone like Dr. Oz, but that's an entirely different discussion. Though, unfortunately, you were mentioning, Vicky, about how you wish Warnock might come out victorious in the Georgia race. A report by The Hill and the Daily Mail, in fact, only a matter of yesterday, time zones are a thing, but in the afternoon in the US, had Walker have a slight lead overall in state for the Senate position. He's particularly, as with most things though, where you are seeing kind of the split when it comes to general trends with Republicans and Democrats in this era, with a Warnock having a more of a lead in urban areas compared to Walker having more of a lead in rural areas, which go stereotypically Democrat and Republican respectively. So yeah, I do hope that potentially this might just be a slight quirk of a particular poll, but we are yet to see. It's very, as we've mentioned throughout, the polls could be very wrong, and we will not know what the situation is until November.
Yeah, there is certainly a lot that's going on. One thing that is very interesting, actually, you know how I've been saying all this podcast that there are 35 Senate seats up for grabs? Well, hello, Senate seat number 36, because this is weird. There are 34 Class 3 Senate seats up for election in 2022. Essentially, the classes, there's no difference in the value of those Senate seats. They are all worth one. It's just Class 1 go on the first year. Then, if we count that as year one, Class 2 will be elected in year 3, Class 3 will be elected in year 5. And that's how they do their 6-year repeating cycles, because it's all a 6-year term in the Senate, but it's a third go up every 2 years, if that makes sense. But there are also two special elections, one in California, because Kamala Harris, she obviously is now the vice president, and you can't be the senator and the vice president. A special election is going to be held in California to fill the final weeks of Kamala Harris's term. Kamala Harris, who was going to go up for re-election, I think, in 2022 anyway, which is ridiculous. And then there is also going to be one in Oklahoma, a special election in Oklahoma, because Senator Jim Inhofe, and I'm going to get that name wrong, Inhofe, has announced his intention to retire at the end of the 117th Congress. He told the New York Times back in February of 2022. I just love his name, James Mountain Inhofe. It's so American. He's currently the ranking member of the Senate Armed Services Committee. Honestly, this is not going to change the predictions people are having for the Senate, because he was ranked the fifth most conservative member of the United States Senate Oklahoma is one of the most conservative states in America. There's no way, there's not a cat's chance in hell that the Democrat can turn this seat. But what is interesting, we've mentioned that Mitch McConnell might be a little bit nervy, potentially, about the chances of flipping the 50-50 Senate, which you would have thought, hang on, if it's 50-50, that's got to be a good chance of taking it, taking that one extra seat that you need to make it 51. Well, that's because of those seats where they're up for grabs this time, 21 of them are held by Republican candidates. So there isn't as much room to grow for the Republican base as there is in the Democrats' side of things. They can expand further. That being said, the Republicans have apparently nominated several sort of big battleground states that they really want to take a look at. Now, the Republicans have identified four top targets: Arizona, which we've mentioned, Georgia, which we've mentioned, and two which we haven't: Nevada and New Hampshire. Now, in Nevada, it's Catherine Cortez Masto, a first-term senator in Nevada, who is running to get a second one. She's the incumbent. The Republican nominee, former Nevadan Attorney General Adam Laxalt. He lost out on becoming governor 4 years ago. This is going to go down to the wire. Looks like the Democrats have obviously all of the incumbency values. Looks like they're going to win the fundraising battle in the state as well. But in terms of electability and the long-term realignment that we're seeing in and around Nevada, well, it's really a toss-up. So we won't quite know how that's going to work. Now, the Democrats, they've won basically every election going in Nevada for the Senate and the presidency in recent history. Republicans haven't won a Senate race since 2012 in the state. They haven't won a presidential race since 2004 in the state. But they're putting up a really good fight this time around. And then that one other one, the New Hampshire Senate, where it's leaning Democratic, but that's really just because the Republican primary is so late in the year. Joe Biden won it by 7 points in 2020. There's a Democrat incumbent, Senator Maggie Hassan. If Chris Sununu, is that right? Sununu? Yes, it is. Crikey, I thought I'd really butchered that name. But if he'd run, then we could have been seeing a very, very tight race. But with the primary, it's just swinging around this particular race. Slightly leaning Democrat. Not really too strong, though. I don't know. Do you guys think that these races are winnable for the Republicans? Which ones do you think they should be targeting? And ideally, do you think they're going to do it?
I think they're definitely winnable. I think a seat like Nevada would make more sense to be spending money in than a seat like Pennsylvania, where it may make sense to just go, our candidate's not great. Maybe we've seen some more money and isn't using our resources very well. Maybe we've seen some money to say like Nevada, where our candidate is kind of gaining ground and has the right kind of momentum. I mean, this may all sound ridiculous because we may be sitting here in November and they've won Pennsylvania and Dr. Oz had kind of some magic hold over the electorates that none of us saw. But yeah, Nevada's interesting and could be a place where money is more wisely spent just because the Democrats are massively outspending them in Nevada at the moment. And with some more equal spending, the momentum could really shift further because it's the Democrats are kind of clinging on and spending a lot of money to do so. New Hampshire is really interesting just because the primary just means things are very unsettled and it's hard to get a picture. And I don't think you could really tell whether the Republicans have a good chance there until you know who their candidate is. So you just kind of have to wait and see.
Those are those major battlegrounds for the Republican Party. They're thinking of expanding their sort of steps into Colorado and Washington. Remember, that's Washington State, not Washington, D.C. No senators from D.C. yet. Well, that's just me being politically cheeky, saying the yet on the end there. The Democrats, on the other hand, are looking to make their time in the Senate a lot more comfortable. They are looking for 3 seats realistically, and those targets are Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, and North Carolina. Now, we've talked at length about John Fetterman and Mehmet Oz, who are going toe-to-toe in Pennsylvania, so I won't go on a little bit any more about it. Wisconsin, however, is interesting because, again, Politico rating this one a toss-up. Ron Johnson, though, he's a two-time senator going for his third term. They've been controversial to some degree. He has been, in moments, Donald Trump's favorite man on the planet, and then Donald Trump's favorite punching bag, metaphorically, I hope, anyway, because that would be quite painful. But the Democrats have a strong candidate. They have the lieutenant governor, or lieutenant governor, but I won't call him that, Mandela Barnes, who is running for this seat. This, folks, this is going to get ugly, this race. It already has, realistically, because the Republicans need this seat. It doesn't matter if they win Nevada, if they lose Wisconsin. They have to hold on to their seats where they have incumbents running, because they just need that base to build off of. You can't build a house on foundations made of sand. So they have to hold this base to move forward. Obviously, Johnson has the incumbency value, but we've seen the value of incumbency for people with a surname Johnson in British political systems. So I wonder if that'll work in America for him. Looks like a very close race in terms of fundraising, and both candidates have won statewide elections in Wisconsin, so it's going to be close. We don't know how this is going to go in terms of long-term political alignment either. Wisconsin went Trump in 2016, I was about to say 2020 there, but flipped back to Joe Biden in 2016. It's close. It's going to be really close. I don't know what you think about it, Vicky, but I can't wait to see how this one goes in terms of politically nerding out on it.
Yeah, it's going to be really interesting. And Ron Johnson has obviously come up a bit in Democratic strategy, because they've essentially sometimes been raising votes and bills literally just targeted at Ron Johnson to see how he votes on it. When votes were happening on abortion, and when they were talking about whether to hold votes on contraception and gay marriage, the reason for doing those, the logic behind it, was to see when Ron Johnson would vote on it so they could run an ad saying he'd voted against it or abstained. They really want to target him in that seat, and they think he's incredibly vulnerable. So there's a lot of Democratic resources going behind that. They basically, yeah, he is the sole focus of some of the Democratic Party. And if he can hold on, I think that will be a massive blow to them, because if they can't like swing seats like that, kind of any progress going forward is going to be quite difficult, because if you can't convince people in a swing state, which Joe Biden won, to vote against Republicans when Donald Trump isn't on the ticket, the next couple of elections are looking quite bad for the Democrats. So there's a lot of, and there's a lot of kind of analysis you could do about those kinds of races. So again, very interested in that one.
Yeah, it's definitely an interesting one to watch, because at the moment, or at least as of 2 days ago, Ron Johnson was behind in the polls. So it is very much that incumbency value doesn't seem to be stacking up all that much. But in the last couple of days, it's interesting that you did bring up fundraising, as costs has been one of the main issues that's come up in that race over the last while, by nature of security costs, particularly that there was a article in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel that Mandela Barnes had 10 times more hours of security compared to Ron Johnson, and this was kind of this was taken on by the Johnson campaign about, you know, it's taking up the money of people for Milwaukee. I've completely forgotten what the demonym for Milwaukee is, but people from Milwaukee, and yeah, it's Wisconsin is the state. Milwaukee's the city. What am I doing? But yeah, though it should be noted that those things can be taken with a pinch of salt, as it wasn't the lieutenant governor's decision how much money was spent on security. That is purely in the remit of the state patrol.
Yeah, those Wisconsinites might not be too happy with where their money is going. But also, it is completely out of the candidate's control. So that's Wisconsin. I now want to have a look at a final race, really, of the ones that are properly close and could be realistically considered to be target seats for either side. We've done all the Republican target seats. We've done the two Democrat main target seats. Now the one where if the Democrats win this, you think they've definitely won control of the Senate. North Carolina. This is the big one again. I can't contain my joy at having a US election to cover like this, because everything's just so nice and neatly compartmentalized into this is exactly how this race is going to go. You know California's not going to go red. You know Texas probably isn't going to go blue, although that could be changing with the gubernatorial race coming up, which we'll talk about after we get through these Senate races. North Carolina, never in recent history probably has there been a more purple state. I would go so far to say profoundly blue for Obama, red for Romney. Then it didn't quite know what to do with Trump. It backed him and then turned against him and then backed him again, and all sorts of different ideas there. Obviously, there weren't three elections at the presidential level involving Donald Trump, but talking about midterms there. Richard Burr, the incumbent US senator, he's retiring. He's leaving the US Senate. Popular conservative senator. It's been one hell of a messy primary to replace him, I've got to say. Two candidates claimed to have won the primary. It's still nominally officially going on, but the North Carolina Republican Party convention was back in June. It seemed to be then that Ted Budd, who is the presumptive nominee for the Republicans, won at the convention. But Mark Walker, who was his leading competitor, said he won a straw poll of those people who attended the convention. People who didn't run, almost as funny as looking down the rest of the list. Pat McCrory. He was a former governor. He was endorsed by some pretty big names, including the retiring senator. But then you have people who declined to run. Lara Trump, she declined to run. I believe that's Eric's wife, big in North Carolina. Ted Budd has received endorsements from Donald Trump, Marsha Blackburn, a darling of the MAGA caucus in the Senate, Ted Cruz, a handful of US representatives from North Carolina, not to mention Newt Gingrich, former Speaker of the House of Representatives, who is making his way back into the mainstream political stage, it would appear. But it does look like that the primary is all done and dusted, barring any legal challenge. Ted Budd is going to go up against the Democratic nominee, who is in some way even more interesting. Sherry Beasley, former Chief Justice of the North Carolina Supreme Court. Wow. Who would have thought? It's obviously not that uncommon for people off the bench to go into politics. It used to be a thing that happened all the time. You go from politics to the bench and then back to politics. But you don't see it very often anymore, especially for a US Senate seat. It's going to be close. She lost her election in 2020 to run for a full term as Chief Justice. But now it's a big old chance for her to claim some ground for the Democratic Party in this Senate seat. So I wonder, what do we think on North Carolina, folks?
I have to be honest, it's not to say I'm as enthusiastic about following, because it's just, as you pointed out, it's kind of been a mess. But again, I mean, perceivable that the Democratic Party could win it. I think Politico still had to lean Republican, but who knows? Again, I think it's one of those seats where you have to wait to see how it plays out, wait to see what happens in October, because that could massively change the course of the race, see how bad inflation gets. But other than that, I'm not sure there's anything more to add for North Carolina than like the same stuff that applies to the other Senate seat applies to that.
Yeah, I would entirely agree with that kind of summary. But I would also say this is going to draw on a different sort of political record as well, though, notably. Like, instead of just coming to terms of how, like a person who's held either state level or federal level office before would be measured on their voting, Sherry Beasley is going to probably be measured, and her opponents, be that Ted Budd or whoever, might end up taking the nomination. They are going to be going through every single judgment, every single majority and minority opinion with a fine-tooth comb to try find that key issue which they can try hammer on. And by nature of being a judge, there are likely going to be things which a majority in the electorate do have differing opinions on, which would be able to be kind of that flashpoint issue, essentially, in terms of if they wanted to shore up support for their candidate. It's a lot less cut and dry compared to a electoral record or voting record.
Yeah, I can say for certainty, or as much certainty as I can, it will be Ted Budd. There's just an interesting little quirk running through. I think it's some form of appeals system. Who would have thought the Republican Party would be challenging the legitimacy of an election result? Never heard that before. Let's end this little segment with which way we think it's going. Because I've got to say, it's really in the area of too close to call for me, the Senate. I could not tell you. There will definitely be seats that change hands. I wouldn't be too surprised if Arizona flips. I wouldn't be too surprised if Georgia flips, despite my own personal opinions on the quality of candidates being both better for the Democrats than they are for the Republicans. But on the same sort of side, Pennsylvania looks like it's going blue, despite previously having been a Republican Senate seat. They've sort of thrown away that chance, really, to hold on to it by picking Mehmet Oz. And there are just so many races up and down the ballot. We really could end up with sort of a 51-49 Senate either way. And that's going to be so, so difficult for whoever's in charge. Unless, of course, it's the Republicans, because we know that they can continue to block things even without 50 senators. They could do it with 41 if they wanted to, given the current filibuster rules. You never know. Get a radical enough Senate in for the Democrats and maybe that changes. Maybe. I don't know. Vicky, Callum, what do you think about how the Senate's going to end up? Because I know, Callum, you think that Kamala Harris's voice is probably going to be less important than it is at the moment in terms of the casting vote.
Yes, sorry, I got slightly confused with my politics, and for some reason I thought the VP was the person who stood in the House, but no, that is different. And the American electoral processes sometimes boggle the mind, but yeah, no, I think it's going to be a more significant proportion in terms of, like, there's going to be a... it's not going to be as razor thin a majority. Whether that majority is the Democrats, though, I wouldn't be able to say. I think it's certainly, there's not going to be that same level of kind of, it's not going to be 50-50 by any stretch. It's going to be I don't think it will be by a massive margin, but it will be a definite majority for one of the parties. I just could not possibly comment on which.
Yeah, I think I agree with that assessment. I think as it stands at the moment, I'd be tempted to say Democrat, but I'm aware that could shift quite substantially. I just think that that's where the momentum is at the moment and where kind of like increased voter turnout is looking like it will go. They seem to be registering more new voters, but again, who knows? And I'm fully prepared to admit that could change quite quickly. So it's something to keep an eye on.
Yeah, certainly something to keep an eye on. Something else to keep an eye on, although the news will definitely have broken, I'm pretty certain it will have, by the time this podcast comes out. Just keep an eye on Alaska, where Sarah Palin is competing, not for the Senate, just aiming to get back into Congress. It would be one heck of a political redemption arc were she to get through. And she's looking like she could win, actually, under the ranked choice voting system, which is spreading slightly around America. So you never know. Maybe Sarah Palin is back with a bang onto the political stage by the time this podcast has come out. But just to wrap it up, but to introduce the last segment, because I know we have a history sometimes of going on for hours and hours and hours, but this one's hopefully going to be a little bit shorter. There are 36 gubernatorial races and a handful of down ballot races going on up and down the United States. Big battles going on. Loads of things up for grabs. Now, it looks like the Democrats are going to be in control of more states' governor's mansions than the Republicans are going to be at the end of this election cycle, but there are still plenty up for grabs. Arizona, Nevada, Georgia, Wisconsin, Kansas. You don't sing a theme yet, anyone, about these battleground states. They're all in the sort of toss-up category, and there are plenty of popular incumbents leaving office. So there's a chance. There is a chance to shift the political map. And as we know, these gubernatorial races decide who's at the top of the tree in the state. It's a big responsibility. A lot of governors go on to become president. One Florida governor wants to go on to become president. One Texas governor is at the center of a firestorm right now around abortion rights, gun rights, and is facing a really stiff challenge from Beto O'Rourke. That's Greg Abbott. I don't know whether he'll be able to sort of stand up to the challenge and see whether he can fend off this Democratic challenge, but it looks like he will. But his credibility in this heavily Republican state could end up severely dented. In other battles that are also very fun to look at, Kansas Governor Laura Kelly is fighting a tough, tough race to hold on to the state house there in Topeka. Democratic incumbents also have their backs against the wall in a few states. You're looking at Wisconsin and Nevada, particularly up in the air. And then you've got some Democratic incumbents who look like they might retain their seats, but have a tough time doing it. You've got Maine, Michigan, New Mexico. Oregon and Pennsylvania look like they will be able to stay blue just because they're having an open seat race. It's not often you see an open seat race, no incumbent running. Massachusetts and Maryland, they have two great pickup opportunities there, the Democrats, fighting against a new Republican challenger after popular incumbents leave the office. So this is going to be close, but I wonder, what do you guys think, especially because we've seen governors and secretaries of state have such big impacts in recent times, especially around the certification issues in 2020. Is this the most attention we've seen on gubernatorial races for a while? And what does that do for the candidates here?
I mean, yeah, in some ways, these are some of the most important elections, because if these go wrong in a couple of states, you're looking at real trouble certifying the next election. In the DA races, which I'm not sure there's as many this midterms, but really kind of happening kind of consistently for a while, you're looking at how abortion rules are written in a state. It's basically on the ballot. So these are probably the elections that are going to affect people the most, just due to the fact that nothing really ever gets done in the American government, like nationally, and stuff gets done at the state level. Like a lot of stuff gets done, and that can massively affect how you live your life. The racist you pointed out, I mean Beto, I think it's unlikely. I think he's done all he can. He's made a real impact, and I think it'll be closer than it's been in a while. But I think it's a long way to go in Texas. And perhaps this is just kind of part of a journey to turning Texas to a more swing state. But I'm not sure we're at the end of that journey yet. Someone else who points out, I know Ron DeSantis is quite a safe seat in Florida, but I'd like to see maybe some shifts there, because he, if it goes well for him, I think he's likely to use it as a push off to run for president. But who knows? He hasn't been very clear about where he lies on the whole is Donald Trump truly the president or not scale, and that could create some problems for him in running. But yeah, very interesting to watch, and kind of I think some of the most volatile races, because they can change massively as opposed to what happens in the state, like natural disasters, crime incidents can really swing those races just because they're so local. So probably some of the most volatile to change in the coming months.
Yeah, no, I'd entirely agree. I mean, it was one of those things where it just came to mind that some of the most, in a sense to show how significant these state level elections are, some of the most heinous crimes a person can be prosecuted for, like particularly murder was the one that came to mind, is a state crime. It's not a federal crime. And that just goes to show that the state holds a lot of power, essentially, and a lot of power over people's lives. You mentioned, Vicky, you mentioned about how this was going to be about abortion rights, but it's also going to be on issues like gay marriage and general LGBTQ rights, the ability to the free exchange of ideas, and there is democracy in a sense is going to be on the ballot again. I know that was said about the 2020 election, and that was said about the 2016 election and the 2018, and probably a whole bunch besides that. But again and again, we have been seeing consistent actions trying to against democracy in a sense, which when it's coming up to an election is important to remember. I would agree that both Ron DeSantis and Greg Abbott are in fairly secure seats. I mean, but I would say that recent controversies might mean they're not quite as secure as they may have been matter of election cycle ago in Texas, with the recent tragedies, well, relatively recent tragedy in Uvalde, and consequent loosening of gun restrictions by Greg Abbott, which notably we obviously mentioned Beto O'Rourke, comparative to when he was making a Senate run for the Senate, and comparative for when his presidential campaign, genuinely angry and like, I think a lot mincing his words a lot less than when he was on the campaign trail before. But in, I'm afraid I don't even know who the Democrat contender is for the gubernatorial role in Florida, but I do think with recent, with what was termed, amongst other things, the Don't Say Gay bill in Florida, I think Ron DeSantis will be finding, even in such a kind of so red, and you would think it would be bleeding state, essentially, I think we are going to be looking at a lot closer election than I think they would be necessarily comfortable with, even if it's still comfortably that it is still comfortably a win for the incumbent.
Yeah, it's Charlie Crist who's running in Florida. He's a very interesting figure. He seems to be doing all right at trying to sell the fundraising aspect in Florida, trying to push big Democratic donors into supporting him to stop DeSantis before he becomes the next Donald Trump, which I think is a great sell for how that campaign can be run. But he's also a former Republican governor of Florida. So he's now running for the Democratic nominee as governor of Florida. So it's an interesting one for that. I do want to point out that murder is still a federal crime. It just gets prosecuted in the state. There is still a federal ban on murder.
Yeah, well, yes. But you know what? I mean? It was like it's prosecuted at a state level. And it's... Yeah, there's...
It's a hard distinction to make because the state and federal prosecutions... One always foregoes the other. You don't get charged by both the state and the federal government for murder. Generally, it's one or the other. But
I don't know why that was the one that
came.
I don't know why that was the one that came to mind. But it was just, you know, I was just trying to show how powerful the state remains.
Plenty of bits in that. I do want to point out one more state in America, Georgia, because Stacey Abrams is running again for governor. She ran back in 2018. She didn't run for any of the Senate seats in 2020, but has been cited as integral as a reason why Democrats were able to sweep both of those Senate seats. David Ossoff. It was David Ossoff and Raphael Warnock winning those two. She's running against the person who beat her in 2018, incumbent Governor Brian Kemp, who had to see off a primary challenge from the defeated previous incumbent senator in 2020, David Perdue, it's John Ossoff, isn't it? And David Perdue, that's why. John and David. I'm getting my Johns and Davids mixed up, which is bad when they're both sort of key Georgia figures. This is going to be an interesting race. It's going to be much closer than last time around, but it does look like Brian Kemp has a strong incumbency factor. I'm not quite sure how it's all going to work, though, because notably Donald Trump doesn't particularly like Governor Kemp. Remember, there was a long old phone call around the time of the 2020 election asking them to find about 11,000 votes, I think it was, in Georgia. Trump endorsed David Perdue to be the next governor of Georgia. And now it's going to be interesting because Stacey Abrams, she was a rising star in 2018. She's now, appeared on multiple TV shows. She's a household name. She was an active thought for vice president instead of Kamala Harris. She is the face of the Democratic Party in Georgia far more than either of the two elected Democrats are. I would say more people know who she is than either of the two senators possibly even put together. She has great name recognition. People know what she stands for. And crucially, in the time between the 2018 and 2022 elections, Joe Biden won Georgia. Big change, massive change. No Democrat had won Georgia since Bill Clinton before Joe Biden came along. So that's a fundamental pulling the carpet out from beneath Brian Kemp's feet sort of move. Now, Kemp has moved to shore up his position. He's put some stops on gas taxes to try and make himself more popular. Although that is, of course, what politicians do. They have to be popular to win elections. He's also signed some incredibly conservative pieces of legislation. But we don't really know how this is going to go. Again, it probably leans Republican. It's Georgia. It is aside from all the changes, it is still Georgia. But this is the first rematch for a gubernatorial election since 1950, where Herman Talmadge beat Melvin Thompson. That was a one-party state election. So if you look back, the Democrats won the last time there was an identical rematch in the Georgia gubernatorial election. So who knows? Maybe Stacey Abrams is going to win, but you'd say it's going to be a big, big battle. Not as big of a battle as Charlie Crist or Beto O'Rourke have in Texas. But it really is going to be close. proper toss-up this race. Anyone who calls it one way or another is probably out of their mind, because the incumbent is Republican. Both sides are throwing money at it like it's going out of fashion. Both candidates are equally electable in their own camps, you would say. Stacey Abrams isn't going to win over any hardcore Republicans. Brian Kemp, he's not going to win over any Democrats, hardcore or light core, probably. And in the long-term trends, Georgia is shifting from a red state to a purple state. So that's favouring the Democrats. There's a big chance for an upset here. But I think, unless there are any massive points that I've missed out from these elections coming up, we've talked about the chances of Trump candidates getting through. We've talked about Republicans, or as Trump would call them, rhinos, probably getting through and winning. We don't really know who's going to win the House. We don't really know who's going to win the Senate. I'm so sorry to anyone who tuned into this podcast to find out what was going to go on. But it would appear we don't really know. But that's always how America is. All we can really do is have a look, give the insight, see what's going on, track the polls, although the polls have had their own problems recently. Find out where the hints and the weather vanes are pointing. And at the moment, it looks like the Republicans are in a strong position, very strong position in some circumstances, but that the Democrats are fighting like never before in recent history to maintain their ground. Democrats are on the defensive in just about every national scale race this year. They have everything to lose. They can lose control of the House, of Senate, and of the gubernatorial races. But it's going to be very close. So we will come back to this story as it continues to unfold. And I'm certain that if you are looking for election night content on November the 8th, then there is going to be something that we'll be publicizing much closer to the date from Expression FM News, where you can tune in and hear analysis as it happens. But thank you very much for listening to this latest episode of Election Watch. Thank you to Vicky and to Callum for coming on and talking about this. And we will see you in the next one. Goodbye. Election Watch.